Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to Season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jordan Gonsalves, and I'm a journalist. Join me on my new podcast, But We Loved, coming May 15th, where queer elders recount the amazing history they've lived through.
In the middle of Wall Street, they stopped traffic. They were doing a die-in.
And in the process, share little gems of wisdom for the next generation.
The key is to understanding yourself, learning to love and embrace yourself.
You can listen to But We Loved May 15th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
Before we get going here, I just want to shout out a quick reminder to everybody. Go on over to StuffToBlowYourMind.com if you want to learn more about the show, you want to find the old episodes, you want to explore our blog content, our video content, or links out to various social media accounts such as Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And also, hey, if you listen to us through iTunes, through the Apple system, why don't you head on over there, give us a little love on the review there. It'll help out the algorithm for our show, and it's a good way to give back and ensure that we get to keep putting out this kind of content for you.
So this episode today is going to be about Tetris. And it's going to be part one of a two-part series that we're doing on the science of Tetris, the ancient mystery puzzle of the universe.
Yeah, so the first slice is mostly dealing with the power of Tetris and the history of Tetris. Second part is going to dive into some possible uses for that power and knowledge.
So, Robert, I have a perhaps pretty weird question for you.
All right, hit me with a pretty weird question.
If there were no thinking beings in the universe, would numbers exist?
Ooh, this is a great question. Yeah, are numbers a human discovery or are numbers a human invention?
Right, like the number seven. Is that an inherent feature of the universe, or is that just sort of like an idea we've come up with to describe what happens when there are seven of something?
I tend to see it as kind of a mix of the two. Like, yes, there is an inherent number sense to the universe, but obviously there's a human ordering system layered on top of that so that we can interact with it and understand it.
Yeah, I think that's a sensible way of looking at it. But there are certainly people who I think would be called Platonists in this sense. They're Platonic in the sense that they believe in the real existence of abstract objects that are inherent to the universe, like numbers, mathematical objects, the theorems, that those things actually do exist as objects in some sense, even though they don't have physical matter in any way. And I sort of feel the same way the Platonists feel about numbers. I feel that way about Tetris.
Ah.
So tell me your personal Tetris history.
Well, I think it is ideal that this episode is publishing during December, because for me, there's always something kind of Christmassy about Tetris, because I got it back in the day on old school Nintendo. I think I got it for Christmas, so it arrived in the Christmas season, and some of the wonderful music that was on that game included, I believe, Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies from The Nutcracker, which, of course, is a Christmas-themed ballet. A ballet that I had to sit through, or got to sit through, however you want to look at it, many, many times, as I had two sisters who were both involved in dance.
Oh, it wasn't one of those things where your school took you to the Nutcracker every year.
No, I had to, I think, go every year to see one of my two sisters perform in it. And and the Nutcracker is an interesting thing to have to sit through, because the first it's totally front loaded. The first half has a Rat King, it has battles, it has a fabulous Candyland discovery, weird uncles with an eye patch, and then the second half is just a slumber fest of various dances that are performed for the victors. Like, they've already won. It's just all complete afterthought.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah, it does have a lot of great hallucinatory imagery, I recall, though. Mm-hmm. I remember that there's a lady with a huge dress and a bunch of creatures come out from under her dress.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy was on the NES version. I played the Game Boy version, and I also associate this with Christmas. I think maybe because I associate most video games I played as a child with Christmas, because the, you know, Christmas is when you'd get the game.
Right. And then you have that huge allotment of time and to devote to the game.
You can just completely meld your brain to this game, play it 9 hours a day because there's no school and your parents don't want to deal with you during. I totally had that. I had a couple other games for the Game Boy too back in the early 90s when I was a kid. I had Tetris, but I also had Super Mario Land. I don't know if you played that on the Game Boy. It involves weird, it kind of like ancient Egyptian themes that are,
I don't think I played that one.
It was sort of unique Mario game. And then I also had a video game called Altered Space, which involved isometric movements. It was very hard to control. And mostly you would just fall on spikes and run out of air and die. You play a little astronaut who has limited air.
Because I was initially imagining some sort of Timothy Leary themed game there.
Oh no, that would have been wonderful. Like, if, as a kid, I had the game version of the William Hurt movie where he takes ayahuasca and gets in the sensory deprivation tank.
You know, another thing about having it, I wonder if this is the case with you as well. I had some horrible Nintendo games on my system. Like, I had Mission Impossible, which was an impossibly difficult game, and then a few other games that really had limited appeal even to me. But Tetris was a game that I played like crazy. My sister, who was old enough to play video games, played like crazy. And even my dad got in on the act and was playing Tetris. And it ensnared all of us.
Yeah, it does have this very universal appeal, which has been chalked up to several different factors from people we're going to talk about later in this episode. But the reason I mentioned those other games I had on the Game Boy was going back to this very first thing I said, which is that I sensed, even as a child, that there was something very, very different between Tetris and these other games, even popular games like, you know, the Mario game. I mean, like, it didn't have to be a bad game. Other games to me felt like human artifacts. They felt invented in the sense that, you know, that a wheelbarrow is invented. Tetris to me felt like a fundamental inherent aspect of the universe that was an ancient secret mystery. And it just seemed to me impossible to believe there was ever a time when there wasn't Tetris woven into the fabric of physics and mathematics.
So you're basically imagining a scenario where the hominids in 2001, A Space Odyssey, are looking up. Instead of seeing a complete monolith, they're seeing
the long bar,
they're seeing the Tetris shapes fall and form the monolith.
Yeah, and it's got to be the long bar, because that's the most coveted piece among avid Tetris players.
As long as you've prepared yourself for its insertion.
Yeah, exactly. how true that is.
No, I see what you're saying exactly. This it feels perfectly natural. Like, playing Tetris is like coming home on some level. I definitely remember playing it and being obsessed with it, and and was just startled to realize this was a new thing in the world.
Yeah, I couldn't believe. I mean, this is a game that was invented in 1984.
Yeah,
but it didn't feel that way. Even old games like Go and checkers and chess. I mean, these old board games still felt like artifacts. They still felt invented by humans in a way that Tetris didn't. Tetris felt like an ancient mystery. And I'm still not quite sure exactly why that is, but I think throughout these couple of episodes we're going to do on the science of Tetris, we may have some leads about why it feels that way to me at least, and I think to some other people too.
Or it's simply it could just be the case that God itself is the long bar, or some sort of multidimensional shape that we can't quite understand, but fits into all possible Tetris scenarios. But indeed, as we explore here, we're also going to get into some of the recreational mathematical roots of Tetris, and even those don't go back tremendously far. They only go back into the early 20th century.
Nevertheless, I insist there is an ancient mystery at the secret of this journey, and maybe by the end we'll unlock it. But I think we should actually look at the game Tetris now, its history, and where it comes from. And the first thing I've got to start with is sort of incidental to the game of Tetris itself, but did you know that the famous Tetris music theme right there is based on a Russian folk song that actually has lyrics?
I did not know this. No.
The Tetris theme with lyrics. I love it so much. I looked it up. This is the Wikipedia translation, so this may not be the most accurate, but the first verse is, "Oh, my crate is so full. I've got chintz and brocade. Take pity, oh sweetie, of this lad's shoulder."
Nice.
Seems kind of appropriate for the game where you're stacking the blocks forever. My crate, it overfloweth.
That is a revelation for me. Yeah.
Yeah, but surely Tetris didn't just appear out of thin air. I mean, obviously it grew out of some kind of puzzle tradition.
Yes, yes. And so, I mean, certainly you can, if you want to take the roots of Tetris and extend them back just completely geometrically, yes, you can get back into the history of geometry itself. But for the most part, we can begin the birth of Tetris with something that was called a pentomino. This is an arrangement of 5 unit squares or cubes all joined along their edges. There are 12 free pentominoes. They're shaped roughly like the letters V, T, W, X, U, Z, F, P, I, N, Y, L.
That's funny. I looked up some of these designations of like the letter to the pentomino, mm-hmm. and some of them make sense. Like the W pentomino looks like a W. The Y pentomino looks like a long bar with a lump on the side.
Yeah, yeah. Some of them are a little more abstract. There are 18 one-sided pentominoes and 63 fixed pentominoes.
Okay, so essentially, though, the pentomino is if you take some squares mm-hmm. and you line them up so that the sides are touching in one way or another, how many different shapes can you make out of 5 squares? And
exactly.
That's what it is.
Yeah, and then you had pentomino puzzles that were all about arranging them together into a shape, usually something, you know, a rectangle, something fairly simple. Now, the first published pentomino puzzle of this nature, even though it was not named as such, appeared in Henry Dudeney's The Canterbury Puzzles in 1907.
Is that a companion to the Canterbury Tales?
If anything, it would be the section in the back with a crossword puzzle, too, I guess.
Yeah.
No, this was basically a puzzle publication. And in this particular one that Dudeney put together, you had to fit 12 pentomino shapes together with one square tetromino, and I'll explain the terminology here in a minute. That's 4 squares, as you encounter in Tetris later mm-hmm. on. You had to join these together on an 8x8 checkerboard.
Okay, so you've got like a puzzle space, that's the board, and the problem is you've got all these pieces that you've got to fit into the space so that they're not, you know, poking out the sides or something.
Right, and like any good game, there's part of it is the mechanics, which I've described, but the other part was the fluff. And the fluff here was that William the Conqueror had out of rage, broken a chess board, and you had to have to reassemble the chessboard. That these each of these shapes is a piece of the shattered board.
Oh, the story behind the game.
Yeah.
I kind of love that when there's a game that's not like an adventure or action game with characters, but it's a puzzle game, and yet it has a backstory.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's essential. I don't want to play a game that's just pure abstract mathematics and mechanics. I want some cool fluff in there. That's how I get engaged with it.
Of course, the exception would be Tetris.
Exactly, yes, because there is... We'll discuss some that have some fluff added on, and sometimes the fluff is delightful, but for the most part, Tetris is the exception to the rule.
Okay, but so William the Conqueror gets a chessboard, smashes it into a bunch of pentominoes, and you've got to fit them back together?
Right. Though, of course, they're not called pentominoes at the time. It's not until 1953 that American professor Solomon W. Golom actually coins the term. So what he did is he took the word domino, which, of course, we know is a little block that you line up and play dominoes with, or you do cascading
it's
dominoes.
The guy who makes the pizza, yeah.
Exactly. That sort of domino. So he took the word domino, and then he treated it kind of whimsically as if it was diomino, as if omino were a shape and die referred to the number of squares or cubes making it up.
Because there are two squares in a domino.
Exactly. So he said, what if there were other ominos? In this case, a pentomino is penta, or five, plus omino. Likewise, we already mentioned tetromino, which would be tetra, four, plus omino, right? And he also threw out just a general polyominoes, a term for these various constructions, depending on how many different square or cube elements are making them up.
So there could be like sextominoes or septominoes.
Exactly.
Though I imagine as you go higher and higher up the list of cardinal numbers there, the number of possible shapes just explodes, right? Mm-hmm. Because as you add more squares to move around in different positions, you could probably make an ultimately infinite number of shapes.
Yeah, like, I mean, the bigger ones are going to resemble full-blown levels from video games or, you know, or dungeoning adventures from Dungeons and Dragons with each of the cubes, right? Now, all of this comes to a head publicly with his 1954 article, Checkerboards and Polyominoes in American Mathematical Monthly. And this really came out, this kick-started a lot of interest in these shapes and the kind of puzzles you could have with them.
Okay. So, pentomino puzzles, good stuff, big business.
Yeah, well, I mean, as big business as you're going to have in recreational mathematics in the mid-20th century.
Yeah.
But it certainly...
We're not talking about Marlboros here.
Right. But it's catching on. It already has an addictive property to it. And then in 1958, it actually launches off the pen and paper, off the table, and into the world of computers, because at this point we end up with a computer program that generates solutions for an 8x8 polyomino puzzle.
So we're already obsolete.
Yeah, we're already getting the human element out of it, and we're already seeing it take off into the world of computer programming in a very early stage.
So I imagine if you're just trying to cram pieces together into a checkerboard, and you've got a fixed number of pieces and a fixed board size, there are a limited number of solutions, right?
Yeah, according to the University of Victoria Department of Computer Sciences, it's now known that there are 2,339 solutions for the 6x10 rectangle, 1,010 solutions for the 5x12 rectangle, 368 solutions for the 4x15 rectangle, and 2 solutions for the 3x20 rectangle.
Oh.
So, this idea, this new, type of shape puzzle, just taking off in the world of recreational mathematics, finding a warm home there, and that's the sort of soil from which this maddening Tetris vine emerges. And the interesting thing here is you can even factor in some interesting non-Tetris stuff here. For instance, John Horton Conway's 1970 Game of Life cellular automaton simulation.
Whoa, what is that?
I think we may have mentioned it on here in some past episodes, and we should probably discover it in more depth later on, but it's essentially a very simple geometric-based simulation. Many of you may have seen images from this where it basically looks like crazy little Tetris shapes moving around and changing form on a screen.
Sort of one of those cell evolution simulators.
Exactly.
Along those lines.
Yeah, the big one, really. yeah, it's a fascinating topic unto its own, so we may have to come back on that one at a later date.
Okay, well, you have laid the soil out of which you, as you say, the vines of Tetris grow, but I think we should turn to the vines themselves, because what fascinating vines they are. Mm-hmm. A lot of people might not have guessed this, though some people probably already know the story. The creation of Tetris, strangely enough, takes place in a 1980s Soviet computing lab in Moscow, with a slightly bored artificial intelligence researcher discovering the ancient secret of Tetris under the ruse of testing computer hardware capabilities. So the creator of Tetris is named Alexey Pajitnov, and he was a computer programmer and artificial intelligence researcher working for the Academy of Science of the USSR, so the Soviet Union's own Academy of Science. And he was working in a lab that would occasionally be sent a new piece of computer hardware. And in this case, in the case of Tetris, they were sent this thing called the Electronica 60.
Ooh, it sounds fancy.
Yeah, wonderful. And a part of Pajitnov's duties would be to create software to run on the new computers or the new hardware they're being sent in order to test what it was capable of. So to say like, oh, okay, yeah, this computer's fine because it can run this demanding piece of software. A-okay. So in Pajitnov's own words, this became his, quote, excuse for making games, which, I mean, that's got to be a pretty cool job comparatively in the Soviet Union in 1984.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a pretty great situation anywhere where you find the way to make your job even more engaging, or make it engaging to begin with, without actually just completely knocking off and doing your own thing.
Right. So Pajitnov's in this lab testing the Electronica 60, and what he comes up with to test it is Tetris. Tetris is one of these games he creates, and I don't know to what extent we really should try to describe Tetris, because I feel like almost everybody who's going to be listening to this has seen Tetris.
Yeah.
If you haven't, you should go watch a video of somebody playing Tetris on YouTube or
something.
Yeah, or
find any number of official Tetris or Tetris knockoff versions that you can just play online.
Yeah, I found a free website. I don't know if this is legal. It's probably not, actually. But I found a website that has an emulator that will emulate the NES version of Tetris that's in browser, and it's pretty great. The NES version, I really like the graphics.
Yeah. It was a great use of the simple graphics to deliver the Tetris experience.
Though I do still prefer the music from the Game Boy version. But Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy is good too. Either way, you should play Tetris a little, get in the mood for this episode. You can pause right here, go do that, and come back if you like. Otherwise, we will continue. But basically what Tetris is you've got seven blocks of different shapes, and these are the tetrominoes that we were talking about earlier. And they fall from the top of the screen toward the bottom of the screen on a little playing area. And the player can move the blocks around left to right and can rotate them in increments of 90 degrees. So you can flip the piece and you can move it side to side. But what you can't do is stop it from falling. Mm-hmm. There's the inexorable creep toward the bottom of the screen. And so what the player does is arrange the blocks to form and then clear solid horizontal lines.
Oh, yeah, that satisfying moment where you have blocks all the way across a single line, and then that line just vanishes.
Yeah, and so if the blocks stack up all the way to the top of the screen, the game is over. Interestingly enough, Pajitnov said that originally the lines did not clear in the version of the game he was making, that you would just try to stack them, but he found that the screen filled up too quick. You know, you'd make these stacked rows, and eventually it reached the top of the screen. So then he came up with the idea of every time you created a solid row, having it vanish and just turn into magical abstract points.
And I think that's interesting because you can see the roots of the recreational mathematical puzzle there, right?
Yes.
Because you wouldn't have that much space if you were just filling this out on a sheet of paper.
Yeah. Yeah, so if the blocks stack up all the way to the top of the screen, of course, game's over. That's your death in the game terms.
Mm-hmm.
And as the game goes on, the blocks begin to fall faster and faster, which, of course, makes it harder to fit them in as time goes on. And eventually, in most versions of the game, you get to something that the players would call a kill screen or a death screen, which is, in the NES version at least, level 29, or the transition between level 29 and 30, where the blocks just fall so fast, it's impossible to play anymore.
Right.
You cannot continue. Though, actually, before we did this episode, I watched a documentary called The Ecstasy of Order about Tetris Champions, mm-hmm. which I recommend if y'all at home want to watch it. It was really interesting. And there were a couple of players who do manage to get to level 30 in it. It's a very brief, fleeting victory.
Does it? So the game itself does not stop and say, hey, you've won Tetris, but you've made it to a threshold of survivability that no one else has reached.
Right.
Or the vast majority of players do not.
It's not like you've won. You've mm-hmm. still died. You've just died a little bit farther along the trail than anybody else has gone before.
Okay.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's an interesting thing about Tetris 2. You can never win. There is no winning. There's only getting farther before you die, which makes Tetris a lot like life.
It is, yeah, and probably a good lesson for a young gamer to encounter, where you, especially if you're up against the impossibility of Mission Impossible, where there's just no getting to the end of it, and you just feel constantly like a
Metal
failure.
Gear, these dogs won't stop. Well, now I'll play Tetris.
It's like the experience of the game is, you're never going to get your money's worth out of that game because you're not getting to the end of it, to the narrative end of the game. But there is no narrative in Tetris other than the simple narrative of shapes coming at you,
right.
Better stack them and try to stave off the inevitable.
Yeah, so what happened when Alexei Pajitnov made this game? So he claimed he was inspired by his love of puzzle games like Pentominoes, the ones we were talking about before, and he came up with the mechanics of Tetris with Pentominoes in mind, but then he decided to go with Tetrominoes to simplify things, basically to make the game simpler. Fun fact, since the Electronica 60 that he was using had very little in the way of graphical capabilities, the original shapes were made out of text characters. I think they were brackets.
Huh. Okay, so, well, that would make sense.
So falling shapes made out of brackets.
I do want to throw in that if there are plenty of other knockoffs of Tetris out there, and apparently some of them do use Pentominoes rather than Tetrominoes.
Oh, dude, in preparing for this episode, I played one.
Yeah?
There's one online called Pentris that uses, not Pentrist, but Pentris, like Tetris.
Yeah.
And it uses Pentominoes, and at least in the time I played it, it was significantly harder than Tetris.
Yeah, yeah, I imagine it would be. Just one more piece. Likewise, if you were to play Tetris with simpler shapes, I imagine it would, the game would fall apart too easily. Like, what if you were playing them with dominoes? That would just be base level way too easy to the point of you would get bored of it almost immediately.
Yeah, I think four really is the perfect number. I will argue very strongly in that proposition's defense. But anyway, Pajitnov recounts to The Guardian where he told his own story about this. He says, quote, "I pretended I was debugging my program, but in truth, I just couldn't stop playing it. When other people tried it, they couldn't either. It was so abstract. That was its great quality. It appealed to everybody." And I think this may be something about why so many people can get into Tetris, even people who don't usually play video games. They can pick up Tetris and immediately feel at home and intrigued. And I think it has something to do with the lack of representational nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like geometrical art you might see in a mosque or something. You know, it's like it doesn't have characters or familiar objects. It's just shapes and space and time and movement. Utterly universal.
Yeah, yeah, completely devoid of any dependency on its similarity to a real world scenario. It's completely in its own universe.
Yeah.
So what happens when you create an amazing and addictive game while employed by the Soviet Union?
Well, that was an interesting question for Pajitnov, and he kind of feared what would happen if he tried to make money off of his game. So the game started getting passed around from place to place in Russia. There were floppy disks of it that people were taking to different workplaces, and then everybody would get addicted to it and not do their jobs. So it sort of posed a problem. Eventually, it made its way to Hungary, and then from Hungary, it made its way to the rest of Europe, the United States, Japan, and the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
But for 10 years, Pajitnov ceded the game rights to the government, to the Soviet Union. And so he didn't really see much money from Tetris for a long time. But eventually, once that expired in the 90s, he got more involved. And I'm not sure how much money he eventually made off of Tetris. I hope it did well for him.
Yeah, I hope so, too. I certainly remember seeing his name on even the NES.
Uh-huh.
Because your eyes were glued to the program and you couldn't help but notice anything in the system that resembled the outside world.
Yeah.
Such as his name or St. Basil's Cathedral, which was on the loading screen.
Yeah. Or, yeah, if you did really well in the game, I think you could watch St. Basil's Cathedral being launched into space.
Oh,
right?
Goodness gracious. Yes.
Didn't that happen?
Yes.
Why?
Oh, I haven't thought about that in forever.
I never really understood why that happens, but was it the idea that the cathedral is secretly an alien spaceship that has been planted on Earth? And
yes, and it had to use our brain power, the collective brain power of a Tetris-obsessed planet to actually launch it back into the stars.
Yeah, but so Pajitnov gives a pretty cool perspective on the role Tetris played in the early consumer adoption of the computer. Actually, he says, Tetris came along early and had a very important role in breaking down ordinary people's inhibitions in front of computers, which were scary objects to non-professionals used to pen and paper. But the fact that something so simple and beautiful could appear on screen destroyed that barrier. I like to think that's true.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, if you think back to early computer games too, many, but not all of them, were a bit abstract looking on the screen to the point where I could see them being very intimidating. Like, I remember as a kid, we were at somebody's house and they had some sort of submarine simulation game, and you really had to use your imagination to see any kind of actual submarine simulation going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, have you seen any of the old Atari 2600 Star Wars games where they're trying to represent the characters from Star Wars or the ships from Star Wars?
But
you know, they've got an AT-AT walker like in The Empire Strikes Back, and it's a big dog, or it's a horse. It's a four-legged animal of some kind, and you're just like some pixels flying around shooting at it.
And I don't want to criticize limited graphics and the importance of imagination gaming, because some of my favorite gaming experiences that have yet to be equaled by our heavy graphics age are some of those where you had just enough graphics, graphical detail to give you an idea of what it was, and the rest was your imagination. So
yeah, that's true. I just think that there's less of a gap when you're talking about using limited graphics to do something abstract versus to do something that's supposed to be representational of images you recognize.
Absolutely.
But anyway, Tetris, after this, went on to become big business all around the world. It was eventually licensed from the Russians by a video game licensor named Hank Rogers, which led to what was, as I've said in my opinion, the definitive version of of Tetris with the definitive music, Tetris on the Game Boy. And so in 1989, Nintendo released Tetris for the Game Boy and the NES and sold millions of copies. And then, of course, in 1990... Tetris became the central game in the Nintendo World Championships.
Oh, this was, there was the Fred Savage movie, The Wizard?
Uh-huh.
I
think it was all promotion for that, yes.
So was Tetris in The Wizard? It's been so long since I've seen it.
Oh, you know what? I've never actually seen The Wizard.
I remember virtually nothing. I think it was fairly unwatchable.
Wasn't it just a commercial for the Power Glove?
Yeah, pretty much. But this is the perfect game for that kind of scenario, right? Because it's a true test of skill.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it makes perfect sense for this to be the central game in a video game competition because, like I say, it's so universal. It feels so core, so ancient. It's like the ultimate game. And there's something about playing Tetris that is so inherently human. One of the things, an interesting fact I came across about Tetris is that Tetris is considered, it's in computational theory, a hard problem. It's considered NP complete, meaning that even a computer cannot play perfect Tetris.
Huh.
You can't write a computer program that automatically optimizes Tetris moves and always makes the best move, because there is no known strategy for always determining the optimal move. And this is not the case for a lot of games. There are games like Connect Four or, plenty of other puzzle games where there is inherently a best move you can make that, a lot of times humans might not have enough computational ability to know what it is, but a computer can know.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to that and from our Tetris playing experience, because you start off with a definite strategy in mind. Generally, you want to build it up so that you can shoot down a vertical a tetromino and just clear four rows at once. And then do that again. Do that as many times as you can. But you're going to reach that point where that's no longer an option, where each shape, each new shape as it comes, and maybe you have the preview box that tells you what the next one is going to be.
Yes.
You can try and crunch that data as well. But it's very much a real-time problem from block to block.
Yeah. Yeah, the preview box is actually, I think, a really important part of Tetris strategy. I don't know if I mentioned that when I was describing Tetris earlier. I mean, you've played Tetris, you know, but the big thing about Tetris strategy is it will show you not just the block that's currently falling, but what the next block up is.
Yeah.
But after that, it's a big mystery. and even the computer can't solve this problem. There is no computer that can solve Tetris. It's a mystery. It's an ancient mystery. I insist it is. Okay, so in this episode, we're eventually going to talk about the neurological effects of Tetris on the human brain, the sort of the psychology and neurology of Tetris. But before we get into that, we got to mention one more thing about Tetris in culture, which is all of the wonderful Tetris knockoffs
that have
come from this game.
Because like anything that sells millions and millions of copies and becomes a phenomenon, like Tetris, you're going to see other people wanting to get in on the action and put their own particular spin on it. And many of them are great. They're perfectly serviceable. They're just complete ripoffs. Sometimes they try and add their own thing, like trying to use a different polyomino in order to spice things up. But one of my favorites is just pure fluff on top of a traditional Tetris game, and that's the 1996 release Monty Python and the Quest for the Holy Grail, a PC game which included a Tetris mini game called Drop Dead that involved fabulously throwing plague victims into a mass grave.
So they were shaped.
Yes, each tetromino is shaped like a medieval peasant, and sometimes their body's bent, you know, this way or that, or they're just completely straight. But you're throwing those into the mass grave, and the bodies keep piling up, and they're falling faster, like any kind of Tetris game, with the added feature that sometimes one isn't quite dead yet, and makes moving it around more challenging.
Oh no!
Because it's, you know, fighting back and trying to wiggle free, and you just want to throw as many bodies into the mass grave as possible.
Right? Yeah, you got a job to do.
Yeah. So that's the best I've ever seen. There have been various other attempts to spice it up. There was a 2004 mini game in Mortal Kombat Deception.
Oh man, they're still making Mortal Kombat games in 2004?
Yeah, they still make them today. Yeah, and Mortal Kombat X just came out.
I don't think I ever went beyond Mortal Kombat 3 in the arcade game version.
Well, there was, you know, 4 was kind of a dark point for a lot of people, but they've put out some great games in recent times. But the Tetris mini game in 2004 was not actually so great. It was just like typical Tetris with some little bobblehead Mortal Kombat characters. I think they would have been far better off just ripping off Monty Python's take on it and just have, you know, dead monks and ninjas falling into a pit.
Yeah, so katanas out there doing finishing moves on people and throwing all their dead body parts into the... I can see that.
But they were probably, you know, pressed for time.
So that seems like they've got just violent variations on Tetris, basically.
Yeah, but then there's also the sexy take. And I'm going to leave you, the listener, to explore this more on your own. I don't know if there is a definitive sexy Tetris, but it looks like there are various scenarios that involve humanoid tetrominoes interlocking with each other. So it's... Yeah,
that seems inherently disturbing.
Yeah.
Like stacking sex.
I guess. You know, kind of a Kama Sutra group sex take on Tetris.
Huh.
It's out there if you want to explore it. And then I think they also just have Tetris with a backdrop of a naked person or something. So that exists as well. An interesting attempt to put some sort of fluff on top of this most perfect game.
You don't need that. That would be distracting. It's Tetris.
That's what I'm thinking. I mean,
why are you trying to mess with Tetris?
Yeah, it seems like you would have only... That's the kind of game you would only play for a few minutes and go like, haha, that's clever, or oh, that's not really clever. Mm-hmm. And then you'd move back to just playing pure Tetris.
Right. One of the Tetris arcade games I saw in the documentary I was talking about earlier, The Ecstasy of Order, is Invisible Tetris. I didn't know about this before, but that's where you can only see the blocks while they're falling. But once they land, they become invisible. I can't even imagine trying to play that. That sounds really frustratingly hard. I would, again, I'd rather just play regular Tetris.
And of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the various 3D forms of Tetris that have come out,
yeah,
where you're using three-dimensional tetrominoes and trying to assemble them. And I've played those before. I feel like those are also fun for a limited amount of time, and then you want to go back to good old two-dimensional Tetris.
We keep saying Texas instead of Tetris. It makes me think that there should be a geographical representations, or like, you know, U.S. states represented as square block formations that you try to fit together.
Yeah. Yeah, the United States as an assemblage.
Like, how does Tennessee fit into Texas? And I guess you couldn't do it proportionally, because every time in Alaska fell, the game would just be over. But we should take a break to hear from our sponsor. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the brain science of Tetris, some of the science that's been done on how Tetris affects our minds.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ilya Kani, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, we're back. So it is time to talk about something that has been called in the media the Tetris effect.
Yeah, or Tetris syndrome, which I like that one even more because it has a slightly nefarious air to it.
Yeah, so I have talked about how I think Tetris is an ancient mystery. But have you ever noticed how the six rectangular panes on each half of a home window can form all of the Tetris blocks? Except, of course, the most beautiful and most cherished of all blocks, the long bar. But all the other blocks, you know, you got the six panes arranged in the 2x3 formation. You can make the T, you can make the L, you can make the S and the Z and the square. And how the corners of the coffee table in your house are kind of like L blocks that just fit so nicely against the square block that really is the essence of this footrest. And really, when droplets of water bead together on a rain-splashed window and eventually flow away, it really is a lot like how the stacks of blocks flow away from view in Tetris once you've completed four solid lines. And then, of course, you begin to see how the Tetris blocks do come creeping down from the darkness at night when you lie in bed, and they follow you into your dreams, and how...
I'm going to stop you there, Joe, because this sounds like, if not Tetris syndrome or the Tetris effect, perhaps even Tetris madness, full-blown Tetris madness.
Yeah, this is what most people have described as the Tetris effect. It's, in short, when Tetris players have dreams or mild hallucinations about the game. The mechanics and visual aesthetic of the game follow you beyond the gameplay itself into your life. You see Tetris in the world, you hallucinate blocks in places where they're not, and you dream about them as you're falling asleep at night.
I definitely remember this from that Christmas that we got Tetris, playing it for an absurd number of hours, and then afterwards you close your eyes, and then against the darkness you see the blocks falling, and then you're trying to sleep at night and you see the blocks falling, and you're dreaming and the blocks are still falling, and it was never frightening, but it was just, it was like unlike anything I'd experienced before. It was essentially a paranormal experience.
Yeah.
But one that was so abstract, so without narrative. It wasn't like I was seeing space aliens or anything. You were just seeing the pure geometric wonder of Tetris playing through your vision.
You know, I looked up online to see if this had happened with any other games, and it certainly has. I think maybe not to the same extent as Tetris, but I Googled Minecraft hallucinations. I've never played Minecraft, but I just wanted to see what you'd come up with. And oh yeah, I found some Yahoo answers and some forum threads where people are like, I'm dreaming about things from Minecraft and I'm seeing Minecraft blocks all over the place. This does seem to be a way in which our brains are susceptible to visuospatial tasks or images that we have to manipulate in a virtual world, especially in something as addictive and engrossing as Tetris. And this has been reported on for a while now. The earliest reference I can find to the term the Tetris effect, and this seems to be, most people say that this is the first time the term appears, is a 1994 article called "This Is Your Brain on Tetris" from Wired.
Yes. Yeah, great article. It's still up online. You can still access it.
So it was written by Jeffrey Goldsmith. And if you're too young to remember the "This Is Your Brain on Drugs" commercials, I don't know how widespread that reference point is anymore. It was one of the most charming touchstones of the 1980s propaganda war against narcotics. But guy's got an egg. He holds up the egg. He says, this is your brain. He cracks it, drops it in a pan, fries it, says, this is your brain on drugs.
Yeah, great. Great marketing, but the effectiveness of that marketing is a topic unto itself for sure.
Yeah. So the obvious implication is of Goldsmith's title, "This Is Your Brain on Tetris," is that he's sort of accusing Tetris of being a hallucinogen or some kind of psychotropic agent. Yet he also brings over the associations with addictiveness or compulsive behavior, and I just want to read a quote from his article. He says, "No home was sweet without a Game Boy in 1990. That year, I stayed for a week with a friend in Tokyo, for a week in quotation marks, I think meaning longer, and Tetris enslaved my brain. At night, geometric shapes fell in the darkness as I lay on a loaned tatami floor space. Days, I sat on a lavender suede sofa and played Tetris furiously. During rare jaunts from the house, I visually fit cars and trees and people together. Dubiously hunting a job in a house, I was still there 2 months later, still jobless, still playing. My friend, an economist, threatened a battery deprivation, but he knew my habit ran deep, knew that I could always tilt, blinded by sunlight, to a convenience store. To save face, I would buy a box of tiny chocolate-filled bears as if AA power cells were an afterthought, not the meaning of my wretched life." And he also refers to Tetris later in the article as an electronic drug, or, and this is a great term, a pharmatronic.
Ooh, pharmatronic. I like it.
I don't know if that later appeared in, like, William Gibson novels or something, but it sounds like it should.
Yeah.
But anyway, Goldsmith then reports on some research we're going to describe in just a minute about what the brain of a Tetris player looks like. But the term Tetris effect shows up later in his article, where he says the Tetris effect is a biochemical reductionistic metaphor, if you will, for curiosity, invention, the creative urge. To fit shapes together is to organize, to build, to make deals, to fix, to understand, to fold sheets. All of our mental activities are analogous, each as potentially addictive as the next.
So once again, we see that Tetris is a perfect metaphor for just about everything we do in our life.
Yeah, I mean,
not only just the inevitability of annihilation, mm-hmm. but just the basic way that we tackle mental tasks.
It combines the seeking order effect. Like we're trying to create solid blocks out of these, you know, disordered, unfitting shapes. And so we're seeking to create order, to impose order on a chaotic universe. But it also has the task clearance type of mechanic that we use throughout our daily work lives. You know, you have a to-do list, and the most satisfying part of every day is crossing that thing off your to-do list, which in Tetris you get to do constantly. You know, every mm-hmm. some number of seconds, you clear a line and it disappears. It quite literally disappears in being crossed automatically off your to-do list. So Tetris again mimics life.
Yeah, and sometimes life throws some bad blocks at you. you just have to accept that they're not going to fit into your order, but maybe that next block will help you work this one out, and eventually you'll create some sort of order around it.
Yeah, I think that's entirely true. And if you listen to these professional Tetris players, the ones who get really deep into it, you know, they'll talk about the sort of the fortune goddess of Tetris, the Tetris god who doles out good blocks and bad blocks, and you know, to a certain extent, the blocks you get are randomized.
Mm-hmm.
But they're randomized in a particular way. There's this thing referred to as a bag that keeps a certain number of blocks in it, and you get the blocks from the bag, and then it's re-randomized. But you can get a good run where they'll give you lots of long bars, and it's very nice, happy times.
See, I often find that to be irritating, though. Uh-huh. If you got too many long bars, like, why am I getting all these long bars now?
Right.
I'm just having to just throw them on top of each other horizontally at the bottom. I need these later to really drive home and kill.
Yeah, why wasn't I getting these long bars when I was getting, like, 17 S and Z bars?
Exactly.
Those S and Z bars really are the worst. They're the ones that make the game as cruel as it is.
Yeah.
But there was another quote I wanted to read, actually, that was from a psychologist, a Russian psychologist named Vladimir Pokhilko. And this sort of addresses the Tetris effect. Pokhilko was a friend and partner of Alexei Pajitnov, the creator of Tetris, and he was one of the original patients in the first outbreak of Tetris madness in Russia in 1984. He got to play it before it was a commercial item, back when it was a secret brain infection being traded on floppy disks around in Moscow. And he says about Tetris, quote, "The main part is visual insight. You make your visual decision, and it happens almost immediately. Insight means emotion, small, but many of them, every 2-3 seconds. The second mechanism is unfinished action. Tetris has many unfinished actions that force you to continue and make it very addictive. The third is automation. In a couple of hours, the activity becomes automatic, a habit, a motivation to repeat." So, yeah, you've got some explanations there for maybe some of the cognitive appeal of constantly returning to thoughts of Tetris, of it sort of taking over your brain, because you've got the pleasing feeling of solving a visual problem. You've got and the constant reward every time you solve it. You've got the unfinished action always drawing you back to the problem. There is no conclusion to Tetris. You right. never finish it.
Yeah,
it's impossible.
And so failure is never super frustrating, because failure is inevitable.
Yeah. And then, of course, the third, he says, is automization. Eventually it becomes not so much a deliberate action, but just an automatic part of your brain. You do it without even thinking.
Yeah.
I do also want to mention, while researching the articles about the Tetris effect in the 1990s, that I came across some, frankly, hilarious, or at least retrospectively hilarious, scare articles about games and technology destroying your brain. It was so funny, about talking about this theory from the 1990s called cyber sickness. There was a paper from the Technology Review in the 90s called Cyber Sickness, Virtual Reality's Dark Side.
Ooh.
It's really funny looking back on the techno paranoia of a previous age, especially when it's addressed at things that we now consider to be so inherently harmless. I mean, who is worried about A, virtual reality, because it turned out to be such a bust, and B, Tetris?
Yeah, well, I think there is a case to be made that certainly there are destructive elements to obsessive video game playing.
So, oh, well, sure. Know. I mean, if it comes if you spend enough time on it, that it's at a cost to your life. But
right. But certainly not nothing that would, that really matches up to that headline, cyber sickness, virtual reality's dark side.
Yeah, but I think now we need to look at some neuroscience and psychiatry to see what's going on when you play Tetris and how it affects your brain.
Yes, certainly the research underlying these Tetris observations that we've been discussing here. So one of the first big ones came out in 1991. This is from Richard Hare of the University of California at Irvine's Department of Psychiatry and Human Behavior. So they did what you might expect. They scanned the brains of Tetris players.
Okay, this is interesting, because it's not just psychology here. They're not just getting people to reflect subjectively
right.
on their Tetris experience, but they're gathering physical evidence about playing Tetris. What does it actually look like?
Yeah, so yeah, they're looking and actually looking at brain behavior during the playing of Tetris at varying stages. So Harris suspected and ultimately found that the brain requires less energy to play higher levels of Tetris as opposed to lower levels, which sounds crazy at first, because we all know how easy those early levels are. And when you first start playing it, you know, it's pretty easy going.
The higher levels, it gets so fast.
I mean,
that's when the stress really kicks
in. Yeah, you'd think
in.
That would be when it was just, you'd have maximum cognition levels going on. But, so this is what they found. In first-time users, Tetris significantly raises cerebral glucose metabolic rates, or GMRs. So brain energy consumption soars as your head cheese tackles this puzzle for the first time.
So your brain is dealing with a difficult task, and it says, I need sugar, give me energy.
Yeah, and especially with Tetris, and I imagine especially for someone who is a novice to puzzle games of this nature, you're suddenly encountering this game that is easy to get into, but drastically different in its presentation compared to anything else you've done before.
Yeah, so you said, this was funny, you said in first-time users, I assume you meant players, but I don't know if you were making a drug joke there.
I can't remember, yeah, if users was a term that I threw in, or if I picked that up from the original study, but...
So those were the novices. What happened after that?
Okay, so after 4 to 8 weeks of daily doses of Tetris, GMRs sink to normal, while performance increases sevenfold, okay? And so, ultimately, Tetris Masters have the lowest final GMRs of all.
So, as your skill increases and you get more and more, you become the Tetris Master, the thing it tells you at the end, if you do really good, congratulations, you are Tetris Master. Your brain uses less energy to get you there.
Yeah, I mean, in effect, Tetris trains your brain and become more efficient at carrying the cognitive load required to solve the puzzle.
Man, that seems so counterintuitive.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Those high GMR levels, they leave you feeling all amped up. And this is your brain amped up to learn something new and guzzling down that energy to make it happen. And once it has acquired the skills, it ceases to guzzle all that glucose. So yeah, it's your brain crunching this new problem, figuring out how to solve it, and figuring out how to solve it with a lower energy expenditure.
Yeah. So as Hare says, the brain might just become more efficient as the Tetris solving program in your brain, as he says, becomes more unconscious and automatic.
Yeah. All right, so the next study we're going to look at answers that question that many of you might have. What if the dude from Memento, the Guy Pearce character, what would happen if he played Tetris?
Okay, so you're not talking about Joe Pantoliano.
No, we're talking about Guy Pearce's no new memories dude.
Yeah,
right here, okay?
Anterograde amnesia. He can't form new episodic memories
exactly.
Of things that have recently happened.
Yeah, what would happen if he played Tetris? Well, luckily, there's a study that examines this. This is a 2000 study by Harvard psychiatrist Robert Stigold. So he set out to study a similar feeling to that of playing Tetris, that of a mountain climber who continues to feel the rocks beneath his or her hands after a day of climbing. And I imagine this is similar to, you know, that feeling as you lay in bed after a day on the beach in the surf where you still feel the surf, or certainly something that that comes to my mind and also reminds me of Tetris hallucinations and Tetris dreams is that when I worked in newspapers, I did a lot of pagination. I was like InDesign to build these pages in the paper.
Sort of a form of Tetris, really.
Yeah, I would often refer to it as word Tetris because it's just words and images, articles, and you're blocking all the pieces together. And a lot of times they are shaped like Tetris blocks to form this complete whole. And of course, there's the added stress, though, that this is a product that is eventually going to be printed and sent out to all these people, and you don't want there to be any errors. And there's so many places that there can be an error.
If only you could have the crutch of adjusting the kerning on a real Tetris block.
Yeah. So, little pagination humor for everyone out there. But I remember having dreams at night. Mm-hmm. Where I was in my bed, laying in my bed, and the pillows in the bed were either illustrations or articles on a page in InDesign, and that if I moved in the bed at all, it would upset the arrangement of the front page of the newspaper.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's that sort of thing. Or if you're a Tetris player, it's Tetris hallucinations. If you're a rock climber, it's the kind of rock hallucinations that you experience after the fact.
Yeah. So I got to mention talking about the study, the title of it, because the title is too good to miss. It's called Replaying the Game, Hypnagogic Images in Normals and Amnesics. Normals.
All right, normals, this is how it all went down. So Stigold asked 27 participants to play 7 hours of Tetris over the course of 3 days. There were three groups involved in the study. 12 novices.
Okay.
Okay. Novice Tetris players. 10 experts.
They're referred to as Tetris masters.
And 5 amnesics with extensive bilateral medial temporal lobe damage. These five individuals were absolutely unable to learn and retain new episodic memories.
Okay, so if you sat them down and taught them how to play Tetris and then met them again the next day, they would not remember that that had happened.
Exactly, yeah. So this is what they found. So the novices and experts all reported that they saw Tetris pieces floating down in front of their eyes as they were going to sleep at night. Not surprising. We know that's how it works. It's expected.
Yeah.
However, even the amnesics saw the blocks at night, even though they could not remember playing the game. And as it turns out, they actually could play it just fine. The performance of the amnesic patients showed only minimal, albeit significant, improvement over 7 hours of play. So their brains were still learning to play Tetris, even though they had no memories.
Yeah, they weren't learning as well as the other novices, right? But they still were learning.
Yeah.
Strange. Yeah.
And this gets in, of course, into the fact that there are numerous ways that memory works in the brain. There are different forms of memory. The two most important ones here for our purposes are as follows. First of all, in the hippocampus, you have this is the area that registers those episodic memories, the very memories that the amnesics here could not form, explicit memories of actual life events, episodic memories.
Yeah.
What happened yesterday? What did I do?
Yeah.
What was it like playing Tetris? But then the cortex registers implicit memories. This is stuff we learn but don't necessarily have conscious access to.
So might this be something like how to ride a bike or things like that?
Yeah, things I imagine many of you encounter this with passwords or things you type into the computer. Sometimes you can't say what it is. You have to do it and then rediscover what you're actually doing.
Yeah. You've made that method memory, but you don't have a direct recall of the event.
Right. So this study, the experiences of the amnesics here, suggests that Tetris syndrome is as much a matter of implicit memory as anything else, and that the brain is extracting memories from our experience, even subconsciously.
Wow.
And then furthermore, as memory consolidation takes place during sleep, Tetris visions may stand out as a manifestation of that process.
Okay. So, I think this is taken as evidence in favor of the hypothesis. I don't know to what degree it's a hypothesis or a widely accepted theory, but the idea, at least, that memory consolidation is what dreaming is largely about.
Yes.
In sleep. Do you know how accepted that idea is? I mean, is that pretty solid or is that
like
just sort of a
solid
hypothesis?
I feel like it's pretty solid based on an episode recorded earlier in the year where I was researching the power of naps and the importance of naps. The episodic memory formation came up a lot in that. So I think it's pretty accepted.
Huh. Okay. Well, that's interesting because the idea that memory consolidation takes place during dreams and sleeping is going to come into play in a paper that I'm going to reference in the next episode.
Yeah, which will also be Tetris themed.
So this science is fascinating because it explains something that is disturbingly common. I mean, it would be one thing if every now and then some weirdo said, well, I hallucinated Tetris blocks, but this seems to be completely normal, completely widespread for people who play the game. It takes over their brain in this way and sticks with them, and they hallucinate the blocks later. So I decided, as I said earlier, to search around and see if this happened with other games. Like I mentioned, there are people talking about Minecraft hallucinations, and there are people who talk about hallucinations related to other games. So the principle of seeing the world in terms of visuospatial game elements, or even experiencing hallucinations of auditory and visual elements from games, is not unique to Tetris, though with Tetris it might be stronger than average, or maybe even much stronger than average. But anyway, that leads some experts to want to group what we're calling the Tetris effect under the broader category of what's called game transfer phenomenon. So there has been some research on this, but essentially it's been based on interviews and interacting with people who play video games and cataloging their experience to see if they transfer elements of game content or game interface into their real lives.
I've seen accounts of individuals claiming to see health bars from playing World of Warcraft, and I definitely remember, like, the only other game transfer phenomenon that I can attest to in my own life would be from playing way too much Grand Theft Auto Vice City. And I can't, for the life of me, I can't exactly remember what I was seeing. But I would go from playing a lot of that to then driving to work, which
just
was
stealing cars all day.
Well, no, yeah. Luckily it didn't go that far. But certainly the experience of driving the cars in the game was impacting the way that I observed driving a car in real life.
Huh. Yeah.
Which was a little scary considering all the things you do with cars in that game.
That is a little scary, and that figures big into how the media has covered this, this scientific recognition of, video game, of game transfer phenomenon. But, there are much smaller, more innocuous versions of this. I mean, have you ever said, let's press pause? Or I just leveled up on something about a real world situation.
Or achievement unlocked, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Somebody tweets achievement unlocked, Swedish meatballs for breakfast. I mean, that is an example of game transfer phenomenon. You're porting something about the game content or experience into your daily life outside the game.
It kind of goes back to our techno-religion episodes that we recorded where we talked about how you can't help but incorporate technology into your symbolic, metaphorical understanding of reality.
Yeah.
And so I'm often think of, like, in many different topics that apply to the human experience, I often think in terms of the health bar and some other type of bar.
Yeah.
Whether you talk, particularly I remember in researching willpower and how willpower works and its status is this kind of depletable resource in the human mind. You end up thinking about video games as the logical way to make sense of that and to picture it.
Yeah, so some media coverage about exactly the kind of thing you're talking about, the intersection of science and video games, is of course not so sensible, and as we've said, this example is no exception. In response to the game transfer phenomenon, I know one UK newspaper ran the headline, "Gamers can't tell real world from fantasy." And generally much coverage has focused on sensational, violent implications of this kind of faulty premise. The researchers themselves disown that kind of coverage. They're like, no, that's not what we're saying. Almost all of this is harmless. And they compare it to the ways we incorporate other metaphors from other types of content and media we consume into our lives. I mean, it's just, you could express things in terms of a TV show you watched or a book you read. When you participate with media, you get some metaphors or some, cognitive sticking points from it.
Yeah, like,
it's not that weird.
Yeah, like, think of any other phrases that we have, you know, fast forwarding through something. Again, pressing pause on something.
Yeah.
Or, let's put a pin in this, which of course indicates that the speaker, likes to torture insects in his spare time. So keep that one in mind.
Yeah, the malevolent lepidopterist of your office. Yeah, so while the using the phrase achievement unlocked or something isn't all that weird, I do still think the Tetris effect is remarkable and strange. The idea of these consistent and nearly universal Tetris hallucinations and dreams. And that makes me wonder, well, does the Tetris effect belong in this category of game transfer phenomena? Or is it something unique? Is it something on a separate and a different level, pretty much?
I feel like it might be. And in the next episode that we're doing on Tetris, I think we'll see elements of that. Now, I've been thinking about it in terms of Tetris being the purest form of the drug.
Yeah.
And you can certainly, and maybe you should dilute the purity of that drug when you're applying it in certain scenarios.
Right, because like spice, it may enable you to have some precognition and to stand at the top of the dune of the universe of space-time and see beyond what normal humans can, but you've got to keep coming back.
Oh, man. I wonder how spice would affect your ability to play Tetris. Like, what would
you'd see the entire bag. Your preview screen would have hundreds of blocks in it.
Oh, and then the guild navigator, of course, would make sure to pick the best block possible for the next turn, whatever the safest block choice is.
But as we've showed, there is no such thing. There is no optimal Tetris play. There's better and worse Tetris play, but there's no perfect Tetris play.
Ah, so would you be able to find that golden path in through Tetris? You couldn't, I guess.
Yeah, it's an unsolved game, yeah. Huh. Anyway, we are so excited about the science of Tetris that we're going to come back next time to talk about some very fascinating Tetris research, more about how Tetris interacts with our brains, We're going to talk about why Tetris feels so good to play, but we're also going to talk about Tetris-based therapies for the Tetris cure, essentially.
Yeah, so we're going to continue to dive into the power of Tetris, but then what can we do with that power? How can we utilize it? How can we harness Tetris and use it to improve our lives?
In the meantime, if you haven't played Tetris in a while, I encourage you to unlock that ancient secret yet again. Open the puzzle box, play a little bit of Tetris, and then come back and visit with us again next time and share in the deep mystery and wonder of the Platonic puzzle universe with us.
So, until next time, check out stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all of our blog posts, our podcast episodes, our videos, and indeed the landing page for this episode will include links out to some related materials on the site, as well as some of the resources we've been discussing here with you today.
And if you want to get in touch with us and let us know your personal Tetris history or your thoughts about cognition, human neurology, and video game play, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jordan Gonsalves, and I'm a journalist. Join me on my new podcast, But We Loved, coming May 15th, where queer elders recount the amazing history they've lived through.
In the middle of Wall Street, they stopped traffic. They were doing a die-in.
And in the process, share little gems of wisdom for the next generation.
The key is to understanding yourself, learning to love and embrace yourself.
You can listen to But We Loved May 15th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.